Today is Friday, July 2nd, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, U.S. forces leave Afghan Bagram Air Base after 20 years of war.
It was the heart of American military power in Afghanistan, a symbol of the U.S. drive to avenge the 9/11 attacks.
Plus, UN aid agencies warn of a looming health crisis in Tigray region.
140,000 acutely malnourished children were at risk of dying without urgent nutritional treatment.
Also, Boy Scouts of America settles $850 million case with victims of child sex abuse. Our top story today is in Afghanistan. Officials say U.S. forces have left Bagram Airfield in Afghanistan after nearly 20 years. The facility was the epicenter of the war to oust the Taliban and hunt down the al-Qaeda perpetrators of the 9/11 terrorist attack on the United States. Two officials say the airfield was handed over to the Afghan National Security and Defense Force in its entirety. AP correspondent Rita Foley reports.
It was the heart of American military power in Afghanistan, a symbol of the U.S. drive to avenge the 9/11 attacks. But now the U.S. is leaving Bagram Air Base, about an hour's drive north of Kabul. Villagers say they hear explosions from inside the base, apparently the Americans destroying buildings and material. They are giving the Afghan military some weaponry. One scholar at the Wilson Center points to the American urgency to get out quickly, calling it sadly symbolic. Another expert with the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy says closing Bagram is a major symbolic and strategic victory for the Taliban. I'm Rita Foley.
Turkey sees Israel's formation of a new government without Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu as a chance for the two countries to reset relations that have long been strained. But recent fighting between the Hamas and Israel threatens to complicate any effort to improve ties. For VOA, Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and Benjamin Netanyahu routinely exchanged insults, with both leaders making little secret of their mutual dislike. With Netanyahu gone, an opportunity now exists for improving ties, says Sinan Ulgen of Istanbul's Center for Economics and Foreign Policy Studies. But, Ulgen warns, Erdogan's fiery condemnation last month of Israel for its military confrontation with Hamas will complicate those efforts.
There were now a lot of, you know, personal animosity between the Turkish leadership and Netanyahu, whereas now there is a new political, you know, leadership in Israel. But given Turkey's reaction to the Israeli-Palestinian outburst, now it's too raw to restart on that path. But the fact that Netanyahu is not anymore part of the government in Israel should certainly be viewed as a positive development.
Turkey is looking to repair relations with Israel as part of a broader strategy to end its regional isolation. The two countries withdrew their ambassadors in 2018 over Israel's crackdown on Palestinians. Relations also soured in 2010 after Israeli commandos stormed the Mavi Marmara, a Turkish-owned ship that was part of a flotilla trying to break an Israeli blockade of the Gaza Strip. 9 pro-Palestinian activists aboard were killed. A Turkish presidential advisor earlier this year had said the two countries were close to returning their ambassadors to their respective posts. However, international relations professor Soli Özel of Istanbul's Kadir Has University says the success of any rapprochement attempt will depend on whether further military confrontations happen between Israel and Hamas.
At the lower levels, negotiations will continue. They will just not be made public, and the timing of the rapprochement will be determined by how much longer these events continue.
Even with Netanyahu no longer in power, Galia Lindenstrauss of Tel Aviv's Institute for National Security Studies says Erdogan still has several critics remaining in Israel's new government. But Lindenstrauss says the inclusion of an Arab party within the new coalition could facilitate efforts to improve Turkish-Israeli ties. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
UN aid agencies warn of a looming humanitarian catastrophe in northern Ethiopia's battle-scarred Tigray region if they are not prevented from delivering life-saving assistance to the stricken area. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The Ethiopian government's tenuous unilateral ceasefire in Tigray after 8 months of conflict has not got off to a good start. The UN Refugee Agency reports the electrical power and phone networks in its offices in the capital, Mekele, are not functioning, hampering its ability to deliver humanitarian aid. The UN Children's Fund has condemned the pillaging of its video equipment Monday by members of the Ethiopian National Defense Forces, warning 140,000 acutely malnourished children were at risk of dying without urgent nutritional treatment. The World Food Program is demanding full access to Tigray to deliver life-saving food assistance to millions of hungry people. Among them, it says, are 500,000 children, women, and men who face starvation over the coming months. The World Health Organization reports the region's health system has collapsed. WHO spokesman Tarek Jazarevich says WHO can do little to help the beleaguered population because access to the area is extremely limited.
We are obviously concerned about potential for cholera, measles, and malaria outbreaks in the region. In addition, Tigray region is also located in the meningitis belt, and it is at the risk of yellow fever outbreaks. People are also at risk of death from lack of access to health services to treat any other diseases that may have.
Despite the ceasefire, fighting continues in Tigray. Jazarevich says WHO is taking measures to strengthen the security and well-being of its staff. He says efforts to provide essential health care is ongoing where it is possible to do so. However, he adds, what WHO staff can do does not approach the enormity of the needs. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Biden administration is marking successes in the fight against coronavirus during this year's July 4th Independence Day celebrations, even as vaccine hesitancy remains high in parts of the United States and a new variant takes its toll. VOA's Jesus Men Oni has more on what has changed in the last year.
Rows 16 and higher, you're welcome to board.
A stark difference from a year ago.
How are you, buddy? I'm good.
This 4th of July weekend, some 47 million Americans are expected to travel by air or road, according to the American Automobile Association. That's a 40% increase from last year.
Folks, we're heading into a very different summer compared to last year. A bright summer. Prayfully, a summer of joy.
This time last year, many Americans either scaled down or opted out of celebrations marking the nation's Independence Day. This as the country battled a second wave of COVID-19 infections.
We have now a very large outbreak. There have been, as you probably know, close to 140,000 deaths, and we have several million infections. That's the sobering news.
With the Trump administration's Operation Warp Speed yet to produce an effective vaccine, the nation's COVID-19 response was primarily left up to the states, at times resulting in contradictory guidance. The number of people dying from the virus would peak to about 1,100 per day. But now, a different story.
The major change is that we have vaccines, of course, but also we have a sense of how to treat patients with COVID-19. We understand the therapies that we should be using, the ones that don't have the greatest evidence against them.
Three federally authorized vaccines are now available. And with an aggressive vaccination campaign by the White House, states, and local governments, deaths are down, averaging 256 per day.
If you look at who's being hospitalized today, who are the people getting so sick that with COVID that they need to come into the hospital? 90%+ of them are unvaccinated or partially vaccinated.
The Biden administration is celebrating the fact that more than 326 million doses have been administered and that 54% of Americans are fully vaccinated. But vaccine hesitancy remains, and the president's goal of having 70% of adults vaccinated by July 4th has fallen short.
We've seen it's been a great deal more difficult to get young people between the ages of 18 and 26 vaccinated than adults who are older than that.
those who are unvaccinated pose a risk to the general population of spreading new and possibly more harmful COVID mutations, warns critical care doctor Tyson Bell.
Could there be another variant down the road that could potentially have the mutation that could help it escape vaccines, and then we have to go back to the drawing board for square one? That certainly is possible.
Surging outbreaks of the Delta variant have prompted new lockdowns in parts of the world battling record infections and deaths, with more than a quarter of cases in the U.S. now being attributed to the variant. The World Health Organization says vaccine distribution is a major problem.
We've got other countries, and most of them the lower middle income countries, that have vaccinated little more than 1% of their population. We've been beating the drum more and more loudly, saying to countries, if you've got doses, share them now.
Medical experts agree that any hopes for taming the pandemic and having an even more normal July 4th holiday next year depend on a more coordinated global effort. Jason Semeoni, VOA News, Washington.
The proposed law aims to prevent South Africans from getting firearm licenses for self-defense. While gun critics say limiting access to guns has proven successful in reducing the death toll, some gun proponents argue that taking firearms out of some hands, especially women's hands, will deepen what South Africa's president has called a second pandemic, unquote, of gender-based violence. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
South Africa's rate of intimate femicide, the killing of women by their partners, is 5 times the global average, according to the World Health Organization. And the big driver of that, they argue, is the nation's high rate of gun ownership. That's the argument from South African legislators pushing this bill, that fewer guns in public hands has statistically led to fewer gun deaths. Gun owners and advocates disagree and say it matters who is holding the gun. One particularly vocal group consists of women, who say the constant threat of violence calls for self-defense. The nation's unacceptably high rate of sexual violence once led Interpol to name the country the rape capital of the world. President Cyril Ramaphosa recently described gender-based violence as the nation's second epidemic. This 33-year-old woman asked us to conceal her identity out of fear for her safety. That's because, in the space of 3 months, she said, she was raped multiple times. First, by a gun-toting home intruder who broke into her house repeatedly and threatened to kill her sleeping brother. And then, by the friend she confided in. She says both men had guns and used them to terrorize her. Now, she wants one too, and is seeking a license for self-defense.
Because I'll have it with me, I feel like I'll be empowered, you know, and should anything that is life-threatening happen. Obviously, I'll try, like they said, I'll try and get out of the situation, but if I can't, then I'll do what I can to save my life. It basically could be the dividing line between life and death. So I feel like it would help empower me to know that I don't have to give in. If I can't get out of it, then there's a way to disable them from doing what they're trying to do to me or anybody around me at that time.
Her pain was compounded, she said, when her parents blamed her for the assaults. She said she had spent years in therapy and has no desire for revenge. But are guns the answer? That's a question facing Parliament in coming months. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
This is the Voice of America. The Boy Scouts of America have reached an $850 million settlement covering more than 60,000 victims of child sex abuse in what could prove to be a pivotal moment in the organization's bankruptcy case. The settlement will mark one of the largest sums in U.S. history involving cases of sexual abuse. The president of the Tokyo Olympics Organizing Committee again has said that banning fans from venues is still an option, with the games opening in just 3 weeks. This would be a reversal of a decision spelled out 10 days ago by organizers to allow a limited number of local fans despite the country's unchecked COVID-19 cases. You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. As daytime temperatures soar above 50 degrees Celsius across much of Iraq, protesters have taken to the streets of several cities to vent anger over power cuts that are disrupting their lives. Iraq's electricity ministry says Iran has stopped supplying electricity on all 4 lines it supplies to Iraq's grid until the $4 billion payment is made. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Iraqi protesters gathered in front of the closed gates of an electricity substation in the city of Kut to decry power cuts that have left them with just several hours of electricity a day amid a heat wave scorching the country. A young man wearing a baseball cap tells Iraqi TV that the situation in Kut has become intolerable. He says that electricity comes for 2 hours a day at a time and is unstable for most of the period. He claims that even the governor of Kut has fled the city and has not come to visit for months. Iraq's electricity minister presented his resignation to Prime Minister Mustafa Kazemi earlier this week. Electricity ministry spokesman Ahmed Musa Abadi told Iraqi TV that there are a number of causes for the electricity cuts, among them Iran's cutting major power lines that supply Iraq's grid. He says that terrorist attacks on power lines, shortages of fuel to supply power stations, and unfair distribution of power on the grid are major causes of the electricity cuts. Electricity coming from Iran, he adds, was completely severed on all four lines Tehran supplies to Iraq. Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV reports that Tehran is demanding $4 billion in unpaid bills from Iraq to resume service on the four lines. Iraqi media report the country's central bank is unable to pay Iran the money due to U.S. economic sanctions on Iran. VOA could not independently confirm the reports. Edward Uranian for VOA News.
Flags of Valor is a company that makes wooden American flags and provides employment for U.S. combat veterans. The company also raises money to support veteran assistance organizations. VOA's Deborah Block has the story.
Eric Wilson is cutting wood to be used for creating handcrafted wooden American flags at Flags of Valor in Winchester, Virginia. After serving in combat with the U.S. military in Iraq and Afghanistan, he says the American flag means a great deal to him.
Here in the U.S., we have the freedom to express whatever religion we want to practice, have the freedom of speech, everything else. You have the freedom to express who you want to be. And that's how I see the American flag.
The craftsmen are veterans, including Jacob Young.
I fought for this flag.
Flags of Valor grew from a home project to a manufacturing company in 2015 that sells about 30,000 wooden flags of different sizes each year. Each one is a proud work of art by the veteran who puts their signature on it. Co-founder Brian Stortz, a former Army paratrooper and Air Force Special Operations pilot, began crafting the flags at home as he recuperated from an injury during a deployment in Afghanistan.
What I found was it was very therapeutic, you know, taking raw materials and painting and sanding and turning it into something beautiful, especially, you know, the symbol of our country, which is the American flag.
Later, along with Joe Seamus, another Air Force pilot, Flags of Valor was born.
I think what's made us successful was our devotion from the very beginning to being made in America, to employing veterans, and to giving back.
He says Flags of Valor was founded on philanthropy first and then profit. So far, the company has raised $1.5 million for veteran and first responder charities.
We do support charities that treat post-traumatic stress. We do support charities that support the families of the fallen. That's very important to us because oftentimes they're not getting all the support that they need.
Besides the typical red, white, and blue flag, there is also a black and white version.
That's the subdued flag. That's the black and white version that we sell that highlights those people that wore that flag in combat.
Stortz appreciates the patriotism and sacrifice of the veterans, who he says make great employees.
I think the unique thing about having combat veterans is that, you know, Joe and I are also combat veterans, so we understand how everyone thinks.
Wilson appreciates the camaraderie that makes him feel at home.
You have that fraternity feeling in the military. This is, you know, that brotherhood feeling.
Deborah Block, VOA News, Winchester, Virginia.
Entrepreneur Richard Branson will travel to the edge of space in Virgin Galactic test flight on July 11th, beating out another billionaire with astronaut aspirations, Jeff Bezos. Eve Johnson of Reuters reports.
There's a new favorite to win the race for first billionaire in space. Virgin Galactic announced Thursday that founder Richard Branson would be blasting off aboard its test flight on July 11th. That's 9 days ahead of Branson's big competition, Amazon's Jeff Bezos and his rival space tourism venture Blue Origin. It's the fourth crewed mission by Virgin Galactic, but the first to carry a full crew, including Branson, two pilots, and three other specialists. The launch will take them to the edge of space. Beyond the Earth's atmosphere, passengers will be able to experience a few minutes of weightlessness. A successful flight would mark a key milestone for an ambitious new industry hoping to go mainstream. In a statement, Branson said that private commercial spaceflight is, quote, set to open space to humankind and change the world for good. After two more test flights, Virgin says it will throw open the hatch to welcome tourists in 2022. The billionaire race to space also includes SpaceX chief executive Elon Musk. Musk has not set a date for his spaceflight.
That's Eve Johnson of Reuters. Private space operations continue to expand, plus Europe's space agency continues its quest for diversity, and a French astronaut makes good, sort of, on a promise to his crewmates. VOA's Arash Rabasadi brings us the week in space.
And yes, we are wheels up.
This week, after first reaching orbit in January, private spaceflight company Virgin Orbit launched a modified Boeing 747 nicknamed Cosmic Girl from the Mojave Desert in California. This was Virgin's debut flight of its commercial satellite service, and CEO Dan Hart told reporters the company expects at least one more flight this year before shooting for six in 2022. Not to be outdone, SpaceX this week launched a rideshare from Florida's Cape Canaveral.
And liftoff.
The Transporter 2 mission carried 85 commercial and government satellites, plus three of the company's Starlink satellites for its global broadband network. CEO Elon Musk explains.
You can think of Starlink as filling in the gaps between 5G and fiber and really getting to the parts of the world that are the hardest to reach, the most difficult to reach, 3%, possibly 5%.
Musk says by August, the company should have global connectivity everywhere except the North and South Poles. Meanwhile, astronomers complain that the Starlink network blocks telescope sight lines from Earth to anything beyond the satellites. In other news, following an open call for applications, the European Space Agency says it was blown away by more than 22,000 applicants. The group includes a record number of women and about 200 people with disabilities. ESA Director General Joseph Aschbacher says the numbers exceed expectations.
I would almost call it a historic moment for us to have so many applicants who want to become astronauts and who are interested in this program. So from that point of view, I'm more than satisfied. I'm extremely thrilled by these numbers and what I see. And this is just amazing.
24% of applicants were women, up from 15% during the ESA's previous hiring drive in 2008. The agency will choose 4 to 6 astronauts from the crop. And finally this week, astronaut Thomas Pesquet, who is the first French commander of the ISS, showed how someone very good at some endeavors can be very bad at others. On Earth, Pesquet promised his colleagues French cuisine in space, but once there, he delivered a crepe made of a tortilla with strawberries stuck on chocolate spread. Shame on a Frenchman, he wrote on social media. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great weekend.
My name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artist. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every